This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld, host of the weekend edition of Washington Watch. Today we're sharing with you a compelling and heart-wrenching presentation we had here at Family Research Council. It's a message Planned Parenthood doesn't want you to hear, a message of truth from an actual survivor of an attempted abortion. She not only survived her abortion, but grew up to tell of the horrors that abortion ravages on women and their unborn children. That brave woman is Melissa Oden, founder of the Abortion Survivors Network. And here's her story.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here. You know, I was just sitting in my seat going, well, it's obvious that anonymity is a thing of the past for me, really, isn't it? It's a good thing I gave that up a long time ago. You know, it's interesting. Arena and I were chatting a little bit before I started, and this is an interesting journey for somebody like me. And one of the questions that I often get from the media, whether they are pro-abortion or pro-life, is, why don't more survivors tell their story? And there are lots of reasons why other survivors don't tell their story. As you heard in my introduction, I've had contact actually now with 210, the number went up one, 210 other survivors. And by and large, most of those survivors will never tell their story publicly, whether it's because of how it might impact their biological family, maybe their adoptive family. I know an awful lot of survivors who feel like they can't put their professional lives at risk by coming forward publicly with their stories. And a lot of the survivors simply cannot face the public ridicule that often comes with sharing a story like ours. You know, every single day I wake up to news and comments about me, like things like, oh, she must be lying. She wanted to be famous, right? This couldn't have happened to her. Or, you know, some of my other favorites. So her birth mother didn't have a choice. And so now she wants to take away our choice. Those are many of the reasons why survivors will likely never come forward with their story. But what I'm hoping is that as I advocate for lives like ours to be protected and respected, I'm hoping that other survivors watch me doing this and realize, you know what, I'm still standing. Every single day, no matter what people want to say, I'm still standing. And so if I can do it, they can too. And so that is my sincerest hope, that other survivors or other people who are touched by abortion, men and women who are post-abortive, you know, maybe they will find their own courage in the midst of their devastation and be willing to help us have this open dialogue about what abortion has truly done in our lives. As you can see in my presentation, my memoir, as Arena discussed, You Carried Me, was just recently released. It was actually released on Monday and is already a bestseller on Amazon. So many thanks to all of you. We are greatly appreciative of that. But this story is the story of my life. And I often joke and say it's a wild one. It's not enough that I survived a saline infusion abortion, but it also is a story that involves a forced abortion, a child who gets to journey and search for her biological parents. And so I want to start 39 years ago with my story. In 1977, my biological mother was faced with her own unplanned pregnancy. And what I know about my birth mother is that she fits most statistics when it comes to abortion. My birth mother was 19 years old. She was a college student. She wasn't married to my biological father, but they were engaged, and they were madly in love with each other. And sadly, my biological mother was forced into a saline infusion abortion. Many of you remember the saline infusion abortion from the 1970s. I think I heard you guys talking about it even here today. That saline infusion abortion involved injecting a toxic salt solution into the amniotic fluid surrounding the preborn baby in the womb. And the intent of that toxic salt solution was to poison the child, to scald them from the outside in. Typically, that procedure lasted about 72 hours. The child soaked in it, their life was snuffed out in the womb, and then premature labor would be induced with the intent of that deceased child being delivered. In my own circumstances, my medical records actually indicate that I didn't soak in that toxic salt solution for just 3 days. I actually soaked in it for 5. They tried numerous times over those 5 days to induce my birth mother's labor with me. And I often joke, I'm a little bit stubborn and I wasn't going anywhere. And as much as I can joke about that, the reality is that I was soaking in that toxic salt solution for even longer than what I was intended to through that procedure. You know, when most people hear that my birth mother was forced into that abortion, I know people start wondering, right, who would it have been that would have forced that upon her? People who know my story know who it was. But maybe like other people, maybe you're thinking, oh, could it have been her biological father? We know men play a very important role in this, but it actually wasn't my biological father. It was my own grandmother, my birth mother's mother. She was a prominent nurse in the little community in Iowa that they were living in, had a relationship with a local abortionist, and sadly, that gave her the opportunity to make this secret forced abortion take place on my own biological mother. After my birth mother and I were subjected to that toxic salt solution for 5 days, finally on that 5th day, they succeeded in inducing her labor. And one of the first things I was told as I pieced together the events of my life is that when I was delivered at St. Luke's Hospital, they believed, of course, that the abortion had succeeded in ending my life and that I would be delivered as a deceased child. But unfortunately, you know, when I survived and was born alive, I was told that the abortionist made the demand that I be left there to die. In recent years, what I've actually uncovered is that it wasn't the abortionist who made that demand about my life. Maybe you've already guessed who it might have been. It was my grandmother, the nurse. Once again, not only did she force this abortion upon my biological mother, but coming face to face with her firstborn grandchild, she still demanded that I be left in that room to die. And sometimes people look at me and say, oh, Melissa, how could anybody do such a thing? Your own grandmother. There are grandparents and aunts and uncles and friends and family members, members of the clergy who are making life and death decisions about lives like mine every single day. They may not be in the hospital room when that child is born alive like me, but there are people who are making influential decisions every single day. It just happened to be my grandmother, and it just happened to be in that hospital room after I survived. In recent months, what I actually learned is that after my grandmother made that demand about my life, a nurse took me from that hospital room and rushed me to the nursery, believing that if somehow other people at the hospital found out that the abortion didn't succeed in ending my life, that they would fight for medical care to be provided to me. And they did. I'm here today because those medical professionals intervened in my life. It's like something out of a movie, right? It is. The little girl who should have been killed, the little girl who was then should have been left to die. People fight for me. But I think all of us, as we work in this field and we are battling for life, we know stories in some way, shape, or form that have storylines like this, right? And those nurses fought for me. You know, you would never know by looking at me today, right? That I was subjected to that toxic salt solution, that I should have been delivered dead, that I was initially told that I should be left to die. You would never know. But I weighed a little less than 3 pounds when I survived that abortion. I was 2 pounds, 14 ounces, which actually indicated to the medical professionals that my birth mother was much further along than the 20 weeks that the abortionist wrote on the medical records. And one of the first notations in my medical records by a neonatologist is that I looked like I was about 31 weeks gestational age when I survived. Those medical records are actually included in my book that we released. And I'm thankful for that because I think that is one of the most powerful tools we have in our culture today to say, this is what it looks like, and let's have a conversation. But here I was, about 31 weeks gestational age. I suffered from severe respiratory problems, liver problems. I suffered from seizures for an extended period of time. And the doctors indicated they didn't think I would live for very long. And if I did live, I would suffer from multiple disabilities throughout my life, ranging from blindness and deafness to having emotional and mental disabilities. And I am so thankful that no matter what the doctor said about what my life was going to look like, my adoptive parents didn't hesitate for a second to open their hearts and their home to me. I was lying in an incubator. Let's see if I can get this to work. That is me. And that's what my parents came face to face with, my adoptive parents, my mom and dad, as I like to call them. That's who they came face to face with for the first time. I was still in the NICU at the University of Iowa Hospitals. And my parents often tell the story of how that first time they laid eyes on me, they fell in love with me. And I like to remind people, that's also why I do what I do, and I'm pretty sure why all of us do what we do, right? I believe every child deserves the opportunity to have someone fall in love with them. I believe every parent deserves the opportunity to fall in love with their child. You know, I think that's the primary work of pregnancy centers in particular. They are allowing parents, adoptive or biological, this great opportunity to fall in love with their children, often in ways that they probably didn't expect that they could. And so it is a love story. And I know my parents' love and their faith truly helped heal me. I went home to my family less than 3 months after I survived that failed abortion. That's pretty miraculous stuff, especially 39 years ago. And I also know it's the love of the medical professionals who cared for me. I've met a couple of them personally. I know how those nurses in the NICU gave me a name when I was left nameless for those months. My name was initially Katie Rose. I know how they knitted me clothing and booties that I still have in my possession today, how they fed me from a bottle even when the doctors told them not to do it yet, because they loved me and they believed in me. And I always like to remind people, if they're wondering how to get involved in pro-life work and wondering how to make a difference, honestly, that's right where we start. It's about loving people. Loving people where they're at, loving them in the circumstances that they're in. And it's transformational. And I grew up in a home knowing I was adopted. That was normal to me. My adoptive parents struggled with infertility for over 15 years. And so I have an older sister who's adopted from another family. And then they adopted me no matter what they were told my life was going to look like. And then, of course, in true God fashion, right, after 15 years of infertility, along came my little brother. Yes, and you guys all realize he is not adopted. And we thought that was funny at our house, right? We thought he was the odd man out. We were thinking, why would you do that? Because look at how good this adoption situation turned out for you 2 times in a row, right? That's what we were thinking as children. And my brother does tell some funny stories about that. They're probably true. They're true. You know, my sister and I felt so loved and so special because our parents did a beautiful job of helping us know that adoption meant that we were loved, and not just by them and not just by God, but our biological parents loved us. They loved us so much that they placed us for adoption when they couldn't care for us. And that's what I knew growing up, and I was so thankful for that. But all of that changed when I was 14 years old.
You're listening to a special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and we're glad you've tuned in. Today, we're taking a look back at a recent presentation from Melissa Oden, a survivor of a botched abortion, and her story is one that every American needs to hear. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more from Melissa after this break.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council, inviting you to join me, my wife, Luana, along with General Jerry Boykin and other special guests on our first ever Free to Believe Alaska cruise from July 29th to August the 5th. We'll sail from Seattle on Holland America's luxurious MS Yuridam, known for impeccable five-star service and incomparable cuisine. Some of the most breathtaking beauty in God's creation will surround you as you rest, relax, and worship. You'll witness stunning wildlife and the majestic scenery of Glacier Bay and relive Gold Rush history and classic frontier towns. And you'll hear the latest updates from Washington on the new administration and Congress. Come fellowship with other like-minded believers and journey with us on a vacation that will enrich your body, mind, and soul. For more information, call 844-872-5155 or visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't miss out. The number of cabins is limited. Again, that is 844-872-5155 or TonyPerkins.com.
America's primed for change. In Washington, a new administration is in place, and opportunity is the new buzzword in the nation's capital. The question is, what will we do with the moment that's before us? What changes can conservatives make to undo the past 8 years? Join us at the 2017 Values Voter Summit on October 13th through 15th in Washington, D.C., where you'll be informed and mobilized to protect religious liberty, champion life, strengthen national security, and limit the size of government. This action-packed conference is one you won't want to miss. Past speakers at the event include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Senators Ted Cruz and Tim Scott, Speaker Paul Ryan, Michelle Bachmann, Laura Ingraham, Kirk Cameron, Sean Hannity, Phil Robertson, and many more. Mark your calendar for October 13th through 15th and join us in Washington. Register now at the early bird rate of $99. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Are you a student looking for more work experience at a Christian organization in the heart of our nation's capital? If the answer is yes, spend a semester in Washington, D.C. with Family Research Council through our internship program. You will get a chance to experience our nation's capital through our rich history and culture and attend congressional hearings, events, rallies, and lectures all over D.C. Further, you will develop your skills in research and writing about the sanctity of life, marriage and family, religious liberty, and many other policy issues. Family Research Council's internship program includes free housing just a block away from Capitol Hill and the Supreme Court, as well as a paid stipend. You will gain invaluable public policy experience in a professional work environment under the oversight and mentorship of FRC experts and scholars. Learn more about the FRC internship program at frc.org/internships. Again, that's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to this special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld. If you're just joining us, we've been listening to abortion survivor Melissa Oden share her story of survival. Let's rejoin Melissa's presentation at the Family Research Council's headquarters in Washington, D.C.
That's when I found out the story of my survival. And I think if you're like most people, right, you hear the words 14 and you go, why would anybody tell you at the age of 14? Isn't it hard enough to be 14, right? You're right. But it wasn't my parents' plan for me to find out at 14. It really wasn't their plan for me to find out ever, because they were afraid of how the truth was going to change my life. And so they kept it a secret. But when I was 14, a very unplanned, unexpected kind of thing happened at our house. My older sister faced her own unplanned pregnancy as a high school student. And God used that as an opportunity to bring the story of my survival to light. In the book, I actually detail it. It was during an argument with my sister that she said the words to me. She said, you know, Melissa, at least my biological parents wanted me. And I was thinking, isn't that an interesting thing to say? We were both equally wanted, right? We were both placed for adoption. Our families loved us. What I didn't know is that she knew something about my life that I didn't know. When my sister found herself with that unplanned pregnancy, she told our parents and let them know she was considering all of her options. Even though we were raised in a home to know about the sanctity of life and the gift of adoption, she had all of those fears that so many women do. But I'm thankful that she was not too scared to tell our parents. And when she told them that, they decided to tell her the story of my survival. They were hoping she would understand the depths of that decision she was considering. So when she blurted those words out that night, at least my parents wanted me, it's because she knew something that I didn't. And so I waited up for our mom that night, you know, asked her to explain to me why. Why would she suddenly be saying things like this? And that night, my mom had to speak the words that changed my life. And gratefully now they've changed the world. But she said, you know, Missy, your biological mother had an abortion during her pregnancy with you. And you survived it. And that night, the world stopped spinning. You know, lots of people ask me, didn't you experience this great joy knowing that God had a plan for you? Yes. I knew in that moment of time, God had a very specific plan for me. But I think it's sometimes too really hard to embrace our purpose when we're in the midst of pain. And I was in pain that night, and I was in pain for many nights thereafter. You know, in my book, I actually detail it more than I've ever spoken about before. You know, I went through years during my teenage years suffering with an eating disorder, alcohol abuse, poor relationships, because I didn't want to be this person. I didn't want to be the abortion survivor. I didn't want to feel the pain that I felt knowing that somebody had tried to end my life. So I did everything I could to distance myself from that. And as hard as it is to look back on those years, I also know that all of us, I think, walk through some similar paths in our lives. You may not know what it's like to be an abortion survivor, but I think we all have things that we try to run away from in our lives. And those were some important years in my life because I had to learn to fully trust in God and recognize that his plans for me were much greater than some of the choices that I made in my life, and that I don't have to apologize for being me. And God makes no mistakes. And I needed to accept what had happened in my life. And so really God put me forward on the path to move, to search and find the truth about my life. You know, I first forgave my biological parents so long ago that I can't even tell you when it was. But I think forgiveness is a lifelong journey. I think we all have to make that decision every single day to forgive and to forgive again and again and again. And so God really placed it on my heart, even as a teenager, that I needed to let my biological parents know that I'm alive and well, and I'm not angry and I'm not bitter. And so I started looking for them when I was 19, started trying to obtain my medical records about the same time. You know, I often joke, this is not what I planned on doing with my life. Anybody else ever lived through that? You probably have too, right? As Arena discussed in my introduction, I have a master's degree in social work. I worked in the public and private sector for many, many years. I was the woman climbing the corporate ladder, right? On the outside, people thought I had the perfect life. But what I knew all along was that God was calling me forward to do this. And so searching for my biological parents, trying to obtain my medical records, that was all part of the process that I started taking, knowing that someday God was calling me forward to do this. You know, I didn't find my biological parents or my medical records until I was about 30 years old. It was in 2007 that I finally obtained my medical records, finally found my biological family. And my book, You Carried Me, really details, you know, what an interesting journey that was for about 11 years. And so part of the work I actually do now is I help other abortion survivors and even adoptees search for biological family or try to obtain their medical records, because I learned a lot in those 11 years. And actually, a survivor that I worked with in the last couple years did obtain their medical records after we worked so very hard to find them. So even though she doesn't speak publicly yet, and if she's watching this, she knows I'm talking to her. those are powerful because they speak to us the truth about our own lives, and that is powerful. But I searched for 11 years before I ultimately found the truth. And that's where it gets even more interesting. During the midst of searching, I ended up moving to Sioux City, Iowa, the very same city where my birth mother's abortion had taken place. But I didn't think for a second that it would play a huge part in my future. And to be honest, I actually always questioned over the years if maybe, just maybe, the abortion didn't occur there, right? I knew that maybe people wouldn't want to share all of the truth. And so maybe the abortion didn't even take place there. But in 2007, when I finally obtained my medical records, which you can see in the picture section, I see Arena looking at it right now, my medical records, in them, they say things like, a saline infusion for an abortion was done, but was unsuccessful. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? In a world that doesn't want to talk about what abortion is, my medical records are pretty clear. And even in one other spot of my medical records, it lists a complication of pregnancy as a saline infusion. You could say that it complicated things, right? That'd probably be the understatement of the year. But when I was reading through those medical records, at that time, I had not found my biological family yet. But when they sent me those medical records, they committed a huge HIPAA violation.
You're listening to a special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Don't go away. We'll hear more from Melissa Oden on the other side of this break.
America's primed for change. In Washington, a new administration is in place, and opportunity is the new buzzword in the nation's capital. The question is, what will we do with the moment that's before us? What changes can conservatives make to undo the past 8 years? Join us at the 2017 Values Voter Summit on October 13th through 15th in Washington, D.C., where you'll be informed and mobilized to protect religious liberty, champion life, strengthen national security, and limit the size of government. This action-packed conference is one you won't want to miss. Past speakers at the event include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Senators Ted Cruz and Tim Scott, Speaker Paul Ryan, Michelle Bachmann, Laura Ingraham, Kirk Cameron, Sean Hannity, Phil Robertson, and many more. Mark your calendar for October 13th through 15th and join us in Washington. Register now at the early bird rate of $99. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
Welcome back to this special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld. We've been hearing from Melissa Oden, founder of the Abortion Survivors Network. Melissa has been sharing her story of surviving her mother's attempted abortion. Let's continue listening in.
Y'all can see where this is going, right? I simply call it divine intervention. I mean, seriously, after almost 11 years of searching, I obtained my medical records, and in one little spot, they forget to black out my birth parents' names. You know, that's Jesus in my book. Most definitely. I could not do things my way. And so he allowed the truth to come forward. And, you know, as I kind of grappled with that of, you know, reading how I fought for my life and the medical care that was provided to me, and then the shock of finding my biological parents, their names, I started searching that same night on the internet. And you're never going to guess what I discovered. I was living in the same city as my biological father. He had grown up there. He had went away to college, but came back to that community. And so here I had been living in the same city as my biological father for about 6 years before I had found him. And after so many years of searching, I suddenly didn't know what to do. And I prayed about it and kept hearing the message, Melissa, you need to contact him. It's time. And so I sent my biological father a letter back in 2007 to his office and not his home. I didn't know if he'd ever told his family about me. And I thought that might protect him a little bit. And so in that letter, I told him, you know, all the things I've told you all today. I'm alive and well. I know the truth about my life. I'm not angry. I'll be waiting in the very same city if you ever want to have contact or have a relationship with me. And I never heard back from him. And I was somewhat expecting that. I was given many years to prepare for that. But it was difficult initially. You know, it brought up all those old feelings of being unworthy, unloved. Nobody wants to hear from you, right? Melissa, you just need to go away. And, you know, I had to learn to make peace with that and trust that God had a plan. And as I talk about in the book, as the months passed, I actually learned that there was a very big reason why my birth father never replied to my letter. He ended up passing away about 6 months after I sent it to him. And it was almost to the very day of the Roe versus Wade anniversary decision that my birth father passed away. To me, that is not a coincidence, as none of these things ever are. And I only discovered that because I had been out in D.C. and I had developed over the course of months a kind of bad habit of Googling my birth father's name on the internet. My husband's an IT guy. Honey, if you're watching, I do listen to you, and hopefully more than what I used to, right? Because back then, right, my husband had warned me and said, Melissa, I know that this is your way of trying to stay up on what is happening in his life, but one of these times, you're going to come across something you wish you hadn't. And he was right. Because that time when I opened the hit from the local newspaper, I found his obituary. And even though I'm blessed with my amazing parents, my adoptive family, I grieved that loss of my biological father. And I thought all of the answers I was searching for must be gone, right? And I know you're all staring intently at that picture thinking, oh, it's not him. You're right, that's not my biological father. But when my biological father passed away, what I never could have imagined is that when they went to clean out his office, they found my letter, tucked in his top desk drawer. And that's how his family learned the great secret that he had carried throughout his life. You know, in reality, I now suspect that my biological father never even knew that I survived. Can you imagine receiving that letter? You know, I was hoping that it wouldn't shock him. I didn't know all of these details back then, but I am thankful that he received that letter. Maybe it gave him some peace before his life ended. But he ultimately gave me an incredible gift in his passing. As I was looking for his family after he passed away, they came looking for me. And that's actually the man that you see on the screen. That's my biological father's father. So my paternal grandfather. I've been so blessed now for almost the last 9 years to have my grandfather and my great aunt from my birth father's side of the family involved in my life. And I know that this is not easy for them. You know, there are a lot of answers that may never come. And my sincerest hope has always been that I can make good out of all the bad things that have been done in our lives. You know, before I learned that my birth father had passed away in 2007, I started searching for my biological mother. I actually couldn't find her through my searching, but I found her parents. You remember that grandmother that I told you all about? I didn't know back then about the huge role my grandmother had played in the abortion taking place. And so I sent them a letter that summer of 2007, again, kind of telling them all the things I told my biological father and asking for them to reach out to my birth mother on my behalf, never expecting to hear back from them, right? But within just a few days, my grandfather responded to my letter. In his letter, one of his very first statements was that he knew I knew my live birth was not the intention that day. And I think that was very courageous of him. And, you know, sadly, he went on in his letter to let me know that my messages would not be passed along to my biological mother because they were completely estranged from one another. And I could feel something in my heart back then. I didn't understand it, but I understand it now, and maybe you do too, right? When we know how that abortion was forced upon my biological mother, it makes great sense that their relationship was forever changed. And that's part of the message that I share with the world. Abortion isn't just about ending one person's life. It changes people's lives forever. The women and the men, the grandparents, the aunts and uncles, the cousins, the siblings. It changes relationships for generations. And I truly believe that that is what it's going to take to change our culture, is that we need to have a conversation. We need to initiate healing for everyone who is impacted by an abortion. And so that's a huge part of what I try to do.
You're listening to a special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Thanks for joining us. We're taking a look back at a presentation given by Melissa Oden. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back with more of her life story on the other side of this break.
It's happening everywhere, and not just in blue states. Radical LGBT activists are forcing potentially dangerous policies on schools, businesses, and other public places, violating the safety and privacy of women and threatening religious freedom. How can churches help protect their community and be a voice for the vulnerable on these issues? What can state legislators do to push back against local ordinances and federal efforts to allow men into girls' showers, restrooms, and locker rooms? What can parents and voters do? In a special one-hour program, FRC President Tony Perkins is joined by Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, and others, including experts and victims, to talk about what some states are doing to protect the safety and privacy of women and children and to defend the freedom to believe. Visit frc.org/privacy to view this event and many more.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council, inviting you to join me, my wife, Luana, along with General Jerry Boykin and other special guests on our first ever Free to Believe Alaska cruise from July 29th to August the 5th. We'll sail from Seattle on Holland America's luxurious MS Yuridam, known for impeccable five-star service and incomparable cuisine. Some of the most breathtaking beauty in God's creation will surround you as you rest, relax, and worship. You'll witness stunning wildlife and the majestic scenery of Glacier Bay and relive Gold Rush history and classic frontier towns. And you'll hear the latest updates from Washington on the new administration and Congress. Come fellowship with other like-minded believers and journey with us on a vacation that will enrich your body, mind, and soul. For more information, call 844-872-5155 or visit TonyPerkins.com. Don't miss out. The number of cabins is limited. Again, that's 844-872-5155 or TonyPerkins.com.
When you think of hot-button issues, what comes to your mind? For most of America's history, religious liberty was fairly uncontroversial. Not anymore. What happened? I'm Travis Weber, director of the Center for Religious Liberty at Family Research Council. Religious liberty is now a heated issue, right alongside topics like abortion and sexual identity. It's often placed in quote marks in news stories, as if there's more going on than really meets the eye. But what does religious liberty really mean, and why is it so controversial? The public discussion of what was once a tame topic is now a point of sharp division. How did we reach this point? A new FRC brochure entitled Religious Liberty, An Introduction to Our Freedom to Believe, simplifies this complex issue in an easy-to-read format. Discover the true meaning of religious liberty, who is affected by it, why it's being infringed, why you should care, and what you can do about it. You will find answers to these common questions at frc.org/religious liberty.
Welcome back to this special edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld. If you're just joining us, we're wrapping up a presentation by Melissa Oden on how God saved her from her untimely death through abortion, and then later saved her through faith. Here's Melissa Oden.
When we know how that abortion was forced upon my biological mother, it makes great sense that their relationship was forever changed. And that's part of the message that I share with the world. Abortion isn't just about ending one person's life. It changes people's lives forever, the women and the men, the grandparents, the aunts and uncles, the cousins, the siblings. It changes relationships for generations. And I truly believe that that is what it's going to take to change our culture, is that we need to have a conversation. We need to initiate healing for everyone who is impacted by an abortion. And so that's a huge part of what I try to do. But my grandparents, that was the last time I heard back from them, was in 2007. That's also when I came forward publicly for the first time. As you heard in my introduction, I was a former college outreach speaker with Feminists for Life of America, because I thought, why not start small, right? I had never shared my story publicly before. And the very first time I came out and gave a briefing on Capitol Hill, because that's a friendly place for somebody like me, isn't it? And I'll be honest, I was out there thinking, thank you, but I am never doing this again, right? I went home and told my husband, thank you, Jesus, for the opportunity, but I am not a public speaker. I am a social worker. I have a bundle of nerves, every excuse in the book, right? And it didn't take my husband and I long to actually figure out it wasn't a bad case of nerves that first time I spoke publicly. I actually had a really bad case of morning sickness with that child that you see on the screen. She thinks it's funny too, right? That's our daughter, our oldest, Olivia. She will be 9 in April, and then we have a 2.5-year-old, Ava. And it's so funny. I was looking through some old notes the other day, and I can't remember what year it was, maybe 2012, 2013. FRC did a little piece before the March for Life where they wanted you to kind of show a picture of you long ago and the way you were now. And I came across a picture of Olivia kind of striking a pose with her ultrasound photo. And she was just kind of prancing about. And, you know, the message was, if my birth mother, or if my mother's life would have been ended by that abortion, I would not be alive today. And as I was preparing to go come here actually this week, Olivia said, you know, Mom, I think I'm going to be doing that stuff one of these days soon too. And I said, what are you going to talk about? And she said, oh, I can't even really get into it. I have a lot that I can tell people. So, you know, I think given her humble beginnings, we all know where she's headed. So if we don't finish this fight, I'm pretty sure she will finish it for us. But it was during my pregnancy with her that I got involved in pro-life work. I ultimately gave up my career to accept my calling, and I'm thankful for the opportunities that I've been given. You know, I have been working now in pro-life ministry since 2010, and as you heard in my introduction, I travel not only around the United States, but really throughout the world in defense of life. We were so blessed to be in Ireland this summer for their rally and do lots of press about the Eighth Amendment, which I hold close to my heart, and I will fight with Ireland to protect that and to protect life. But, you know, I kind of got to this place in my life where I let the piece about searching for my biological family go. You know, I knew that I may never have the opportunity to meet my biological mother or communicate with her. But in 2013, a member of her family contacted me. It was a cousin. And my cousin is the one who told me about the abortion being forced, my grandmother being a part of it. And she was so gracious enough to open the lines of communication between my half-sisters. I have two half-sisters on my birth mother's side of the family. And over time, she also opened the lines of communication with my biological mother. And as you can imagine, those were some pretty difficult conversations to have, even by email. But there was one big reason why they were so difficult. And that is because there was one final secret about my life that even my adoptive parents didn't know. And that's that my birth mother spent over 30 years of her life, 30 years, believing that I had died that day at the hospital. Some of you are probably figuring out, the more I learn about my life, the more questions I have, right? And you are probably right there alongside with me. How does she get placed for an adoption if her birth mother didn't even know that she survived? That's a pretty big question. And I don't have a concrete answer to that. But what I do know is that my birth mother's signature, when she looks at it on those papers, she doesn't see that as her signature. Whether it was completely forged, whether it was done under duress and not letting her know what she was signing, I don't have an answer to that. But what I do know is that she didn't know that I survived. And really, the only reason why she found out is because I had come forward publicly, I had contacted her family, and the secrets started coming out. And I'm thankful that my biological family has been as courageous as they have been to share the truth with me, because it's further emboldened and strengthened me in a big way. But, you know, my birth mother didn't know. And what I often remind people, because people say, gosh, she has to experience great joy knowing that you're alive. Well, that's right, she does. And if you're tuning in, I thank you to my biological mother for all of the communication and your love and your support. But the fact that I'm alive doesn't change what was done to her. The fact that I'm alive doesn't change what was done to me. We cannot negate those things. And so this has been a long journey for her. But we spent about three years of our lives really starting to pass along information, getting to know each other, and forge a relationship. And so one of the chapters that I never expected to be in my memoir is the chapter where I met my biological mother. That happened just late this past spring. And people often ask me, what was that like for you? And the short version of that would be, it was everything I ever could have expected and more. And my biological mother and I have a beautiful relationship. I think I'm one of the most blessed people in the world, right? Not only am I alive and I have this gift of my adoptive family, but I also now have this amazing gift of my biological family. And my birth mother, on those days where I felt like maybe I can't share parts of this story, it's way too personal, it's really complicated, right? My birth mother is the one who has urged me on and said, Melissa, I need you to keep doing this. You are the very first person to fight for me. And so I will fight for her. And I will fight for the women like her and the men like my biological father and the children just like me and the future generations to come through every life, right, that is impacted by abortion. So in short, that is the story of my life. And it's interesting, right, because the story of my life could have been very simple. Just another life ended by abortion. But instead, what God has given me is this amazing story of survival and restoration and redemption and reconciliation. And so I am thankful for the opportunities that I've been given. I want to touch just briefly before we move to question and answer. I want to talk a little bit about other abortion survivors, because I think that's a huge part of this equation. I am not the only survivor. Gianna Jessen, of course, lots of people know Gianna. That was life-changing for me to know that there was at least one other person like me in the world. But I spent years of my life in isolation thinking that nobody must understand, or I must be some kind of, you know, strange situation, right? And what I found is that other survivors have felt the same way. When I started speaking publicly, I started getting messages from people who would say, oh, I'm a survivor too. I've always thought I was the only one. And so that is part of the reason why I formed the Abortion Survivors Network, to provide support to survivors, let them know they're not alone, allow them the opportunity to connect with others who know what it's like to live in these shoes, give them the opportunity to share their story in whatever way, shape, or form that is, and get involved, maybe even just in their local community if that's something that interests them. But in the same time, we are also educating the public about how abortions fail. Children like me go on. You know, one of the most common complaints about me is that I look too normal. I know some of you are thinking the same thing, right? I know. It's okay. I joke about it, right? People go, oh, she looks so normal. My apologies. It wasn't my plan, right? It was someone else's plan. But what people don't recognize is that we are truly your neighbor, we're your coworker. I know people who were in the CIA, worked for the White House, prominent businessmen. There are lots and lots of people who have an abortion survivor story that you will never know of. So that's powerful. Some of the survivors that you might know who speak publicly, the top one is Claire Colwell. Claire is a twin survivor. Claire lives in Texas. She actually was united with her biological mother a few years back, and that's how she actually learned that she was a twin survivor. She did not know before that. Let's go back to that. The one on the left, it's a tough picture to see, but that's a young man named Josiah Presley. And if you can see closely enough, he is missing part of his arm. And so he was adopted from a family in the United States. I can't remember where Josiah is from originally, if it was China or Korea. But Josiah is a survivor of an abortion. And you'll catch some videos of him on YouTube. He's done some great, powerful videos. One of them is called Listen to the Beat. I had to stop and think for a second. Listen to the Beat. It's a pretty powerful one that I often share with youth that uses drumming. And each drum hit is indicative of a life ended by abortion every single day in the U.S. And he speaks in that and shares his story. It's really, really powerful. And of course, everybody knows Gianna too. Gianna survived the same type of procedure that I did, and we're just a few months apart in age. I like to think God knew what he was doing quite clearly. And I just want to end by talking a little bit about the power of our stories. You know, sometimes people say, you know, that's so great. They're a survivor. They have a story. Somebody patted me on the head once and said, good for you. No? Thank you. Thank you. Life is good. Being alive is good. Having a mission is good. But I truly believe that abortion survivors are a powerful part of the pro-life movement and changing the culture of death to a culture of life. And some of the ways that we do that, you know, we humanize the preborn. I think we're in a place now where people cannot look at the scientific truth about life or those of us as survivors and go, it's not human. What I saw since the Center for Medical Progress videos came out is a lot of people now are going, yeah, you know what? We know it's a human. And so what? As hard as it is to hear those things, I think that it's incredibly powerful that we know that we're at this point in time, right? Where we don't have to hide behind rhetoric or words. We see the truth about life. And so let's talk about it. Let's protect it. Let's fight for it. But we humanize the preborn and we humanize the issue. You know, one of my friends posted on Facebook this morning, bringing the political debate to life, literally. I said, thank you. I think I'll borrow that term. That's true, right? We're bringing the political debate to life, whether we want to or not. You know, I wish this wasn't a political issue. I was looking at a baby at the airport last night, watching him giggle and look at somebody, and I looked at him for a moment and went, Man, I wish I didn't have to do this. Does anybody else do that sometimes, right? I'm looking at this precious baby going, come on. Sometimes I think, I can't believe I have to stand up and fight for the fact that children like me need to live. I cannot believe I have to stand up and fight for children like me to be provided medical care. But guess what? I do. We all have to do it. And so we humanize the issue in a big way. Apparently, my slides are being strange. I'm glad it lasted till the end. The other pieces that I have in there are inspiring, bringing hope, and encouraging healing for post-abortive recovery. To me, that is a huge piece of this puzzle. Long before I met my biological mother, I had a heart for women and men who are impacted by abortion to know that there is hope and healing and love and forgiveness to be found after an abortion. And so abortion survivors are these very important tools when it comes to recovery. You don't know how many times women have contacted me and said, could you be my baby? Are you mine? And nothing is harder for me than to say, I know that I'm not. But what I can do is say, but I love you anyway. I love you anyway. And what can I do to help you? You are loved and you are forgiven. And we can all do that. And so, you know, when we look at how many lives we've lost to abortion, 58 million, right, approximately in the last 44 years, think about that in terms of not only one life, but future generations to come like my children, the men, the women, the grandparents, the siblings, the aunts and uncles, the doctors, the nurses that are involved, the number grows and grows and grows, right? How many hundreds of millions of people have been impacted by abortion in 44 years? That's why healing is such an important part of this journey that we are on to restoring a culture of life. So I just want to thank you all for being here in person today and all of you tuning in. And I know we're going to turn now to some question and answer. Thank you.
Hello, John Murdoch with Hands-On Global University. I'm curious, have you had any contact with the grandmother? Is she still living? How has that piece played out?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, my grandmother that was the nurse that forced the abortion is no longer alive. And it sounds silly, right, that I get choked up about this. One of my prayers every single day is that somehow she knew that I loved her and that I share our story not to judge her or to condemn her, but because I truly believe that I need to repay evil with good in this world. That is what the Lord does. And so I am living this life out. And so that truly has been my sincerest prayer over the years. And I think people don't expect that. I don't think people expect that at all. And I know that so many people like my grandmother have their own experience. And my prayer is that anybody who has been involved in an abortion decision for anyone, that they find that healing in their lives also. I can't imagine what drove her to that place in her life. And I can't imagine what her life was like after that day.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found this presentation with Melissa to be compelling and eye-opening. You can find out more about Melissa as well as the Abortion Survivors Network when you visit tonyperkins.com. Also, when you go to that website, consider supporting Family Research Council as we continue to bring you these radio programs. Simply click on the donate button at tonyperkins.com. We'll see you next time on Washington Watch. But until then, let's keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.